This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Dear listener, a warning, this episode deals with depression and mentions violence against women. Take care.
All of my writing is based in part on my ancestors. And in a lot of ways, I'm trying to honor them and I'm trying to make them seen. When I was growing up, I could never pick up a book, turn on the TV, listen to the radio, and find people like us or people like us who are allowed to talk about the nuance of their identity. Everything was always sort of neatly put into categories, and those categories did not represent who we were.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, author Kali Fajardo-Anstein on how she's honoring her ancestors through her writing. Kali Fajardo-Anstein was a high school senior in Denver, Colorado in the early 2000s when she begged an English teacher to let her into an advanced placement English class. Kali says she knew then she wanted to become a writer.
She looked at my grades and she looked at my track record and she was like, there's no way that you're going to be able to withstand this workload.
At the time, Kali was struggling with depression. She fell into a deep depressive episode and missed school for several days.
And when I came back, it was my English teacher. She pulled me aside and she told me that I wasn't cut out for school and she didn't think that I should continue on. And she said, you know, you might be a pretty good writer someday, but you're just not cut out for school.
Kali did drop out of high school. She got her GED and went on to get a Bachelor of Arts in English, a minor in Chicano-Chicana studies, and an MFA. She was also an independent bookseller in Denver for more than a decade.
I wanted to share that because, you know, I was one of those students once that people looked at and said, this person will never amount to anything. I know that there are so many students out there that are really struggling, and I want them to know that they can achieve what they want if they really do set their mind to it.
Kali is the author of Sabrina and Corina, a collection of short stories based on the lives of mixed Chicano and Chicana people in and around Denver. Kali herself identifies as a mixed Chicana woman. She also has indigenous, Filipino, and German ancestry. These nuanced identities and stories can be found within the pages of her work. But the road to getting published wasn't easy.
You know, sometimes when I look back through my old emails, it makes me feel so sad to just see the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rejections. I was told that nobody would want stories like this.
Sabrina and Corina became a finalist for the National Book Award in 2019.
Nobody was really talking about that book when it first came out, but the people were. My community was. And my community really carried that book and pushed it up and out into the national sphere.
And now Kali, who is 35 years old, has just released her debut novel, Woman of Light. In this episode, Kali talks about how her life experiences and identity blend into her work and how she's honoring her ancestors from the American Southwest. Here's Kali Fajardo-Anstein in her own words.
My family, my ancestors, you know, we've been in Denver now for over 100 years, and we still run into prejudice and to people saying, this isn't your place, this isn't your city, this isn't where you belong. And so Woman of Light is really my attempt to show the world that we exist, and not only do we exist, we have really big, entertaining, dramatic stories. And I hope I'm providing that space for others who maybe come from these ancestries that are oftentimes very confusing. They've been taken away from us. Our stories have been stripped of us. From 1868 to 1934, this novel spans the Lopez family. We focus on Luz Lopez and her brother Diego, and they're raised by their Auntie Maria Josie. She's sort of the matriarch of the novel. Their mother has been abandoned by her Belgian partner. He never married her, and she has succumbed to alcoholism, and she's not well enough to care for them. So she sends the children north to the city, hoping that they'll have a better life with her sister. Maria Josie insisted Diego and Luz must learn the map, as she called it, and she showed them first on foot and later by the streetcar. The siblings learned to be cautious. It was dangerous to stroll through mostly Anglo neighborhoods, their streetcar routes equally unsafe. There were clan picnics, car races, cross burnings on the edge of the foothills, flames like tongues licking the canyon walls, hatred reaching into the stars. This is about the midway in Woman of Light. When I was writing this book, I was really thinking about the stories that my ancestors told about the things that they had gone through coming from Southern Colorado and Northern New Mexico and the Philippines and other places. And I was thinking about really trying to set the record straight, because something that happened in my education in Denver was the Klan was referred to primarily in my college classes as a social club, as something that was it's just a little club that Protestants could join, but we know that that's not the truth, that this is a terrorist organization, that this is a hate group. Luz and Diego were once walking downtown when a man yelled, "Go back to your own country," and spat at them from a truck window. Luz had cried, wiping the stranger's hot phlegm from her tiny face. Diego cursed, held up both arms, but he lowered them cautiously and told Luz he finally recognized where they were. He pulled his little sister by the sleeve of her oversized dress into the market, a place called Tikas, a ringing of bells. "What happened to the little one?" a voice called, and Luz saw that it was the older boy, David, the shopkeeper's son, watchful behind the counter. "See that?" he said. "Those are the mountains. They'll always be west." Luz looked to the horizon, allowing the line of sunlight to bathe her eyes. David pointed to the mountains once more. "Which direction?" "West," said Luz. David gestured right. "Good work," he said. "Now say this. This is my city." Luz didn't say anything, and David nudged her to go on. "This is my city," she said quietly. "All right," said David. "Now once more like you mean it." "This is my city," they yelled together, until their voices boomed high and arching, rattling streetcar cables and smoggy windows, soaring between stone tenements and factory tufts. "This," she repeated, "is ours." When I was working on the book, I was actually surprised that it was such a window into the reality of today. And it saddened me to think that what my great-grandmother went through in her childhood is so similar to what is happening to little girls and people all across America right now, 100 years later. And so in that way, it did become a direct mirror to the present day. But it, in the beginning, that was completely accidental. Putting this book together over a 10-year span, at first, I thought I didn't need to do very much historical research because I come from this big oral history family that is constantly telling stories. So the beginning research really is my childhood and listening to my elders, my great-grandma and my great-grandpa, my aunties and my uncles, and they would tell these stories about their lives in the 1930s in Denver and earlier in the 1920s. A lot of these stories also were beautiful, but these stories were very difficult in some cases because they talked about the extreme prejudice that they faced. I always knew from the time that I was a teenager that I wanted to tell this big story of my family. I wanted to tell the story of Chicanos from Southern Colorado and Northern New Mexico, these very blended, ancestrally connected people. And I remember it was 2015, and I turned in a draft to my literary agent. And so my agent, she read the draft, and she called me up, and she sort of had this very somber tone. And she said, "How much research have you done for this book?" I said, "What do you mean? I live the research. Like, this is my family. These are my people." And she said, "Yeah, but have you even looked into the cars or the radio stations or the music or the clothes or the food? You know, all these very distinct things from the 1930s. And I was just, you know, I drew a blank and I said, "No, I just thought I knew it." And so that sort of felt like a challenge to me. And at that point, I was set off on this very hungry search for research. And that is how I ended up visiting archives and libraries really across the Southwest region. I remember a particular day I went to the Denver Public Library Western History and Genealogy floor, which is one of the largest archives in the Western United States. And I walked up to the reference desk and I asked the archivist there, I said, "I want to know how my Filipino great-grandfather met my Chicana great-grandmother, and I don't have anywhere to start." And he sort of just looked at me blankly. But then we started, you know, writing down like certain notes and references. And that's when I really started to look at the newspapers, at the clips. But there was one big issue. Our people were not really in the archives in the way that Anglos were in the archives. And I got really lucky that year because I also found a VHS tape. My mother had conducted an oral history with my great-grandmother. And I found this tape and I transcribed it.
"Did she tell you guys that anything about what had happened or why he would..."
I remember distinctively when I found the tape, I found the VHS tape in my mother's closet. She's the one who conducted the oral history. And I took the tape with me, and I was living far away from Denver at the time. It's about a 6-hour drive through the mountains. Every time I would leave, I would remember my mom saying, "Now we're entering the kingdom of the mountains." And so I drove all the way down to Durango and I had the tape and I had to go to the library to find a way to play it. And I plugged it into this VHS tape and I was sitting there with headphones and I was watching it. And the first thing that really struck me was just to see my great grandma again. I mean, I haven't seen her since I was a little girl and she died, but also like since she's visited me in dreams. And there was one more thing that just really blew me away. My family now, we, besides the few siblings of mine that have been able to reclaim Spanish and learn Spanish fluently, we are monolingual English speakers because of the abuse of the past. And my family talks about people being beat in school for speaking Spanish, for being attacked on the streets for speaking Spanish. And my mother asked her in the tape, she says, "What languages did you speak at home?" And my grandmother looks at her and she says, "Well, we spoke Spanish, of course." And my mom says, "Okay, did you speak anything else?" And my grandma says, "Well, yeah, of course. We spoke our old languages too. We did not just speak Spanish." And that to me, it just felt like such loss. Like I had no idea I mean, she was referencing their indigenous languages. It was incredible to me to realize that my family had lost so many languages and so quickly. It happened really in one generation. All of my writing is based in part on my ancestors. And in a lot of ways, I'm trying to honor them and I'm trying to make them seen. When I was growing up, I could never pick up a book, turn on the TV, listen to the radio, and find people like us or people like us who are allowed to talk about the nuance of their identity. Everything was always sort of neatly put into categories, and those categories did not represent who we were. And so Sabrina and Karina was really my first attempt to say, okay, there are these Chicanos in Denver, and they're incredibly mixed people, and their lineage goes all the way back to their indigenous ancestry. And all of the characters in that book represent that. On the morning the flyers appeared across the city like snow in early July, Dodie went outside to fetch the newspaper after starting breakfast with Tina. She stepped out of their duplex's screen door with her hair crisp in black curls. The flyers were printed on cheap, brittle paper with a photograph of the girl, borrowed from the 1955 North Denver High School yearbook, sitting dead center on the page. Missing, Lucia Barrera, 19-year-old girl of Filipino descent. Dodie's chest ached with hardened sadness. She lifted her gaze, eyeing the quiet street, almost hoping the missing girl would suddenly appear beside a mailbox or a parked automobile. "This was on our tree," Dodie said in Spanish, setting the flyer on the table and taking a seat. Tina gave it a glance. She shrugged. Lucia was very beautiful, with strong, precise eyes, and Dodie felt an urge to know her. Dodie said to Tina, "I know you've seen her at church. What could have happened to her?" "Maybe she's dead." Tina gulped a glass of orange juice. "Someone could have chopped her right up." "Don't say something so ugly. That's horrible." "Fine. She probably had a boyfriend," Tina suggested, her voice strained with annoyance. "I bet they ran off and wanted to get married in a hurry." "I don't think so," said Dodie. She didn't seem interested in that. I just read from my short story, Sisters, that is based on my family history with one of my aunties. My family has a very deep queer lineage. So that character that I read from, Dodie, she's a queer woman, and she's basically lost this person that she's had a crush on for a really long time and hasn't been able to express it. But I really wanted to show these Chicana lesbians in their historical spaces because my family, queerness has always been so important and we've been so accepting. And my godmother is a queer woman. And I really wanted to show that they're a vital part of my family, my community. So in Sisters, that story, it's a lot about violence against women, but it's also about having to be forced into a sexual identity that is not your own. Because the act of violence comes when she's basically been set up with men that she does not want to go on dates with, because her sister wants them to find husbands who can provide for them and give them a better space and a better ability at life. So throughout my childhood and really into my early 20s, I deeply struggled with depression. And I didn't understand that a lot of this depression came from the fact that I didn't feel seen, that I didn't really have an outlet to talk about the things that I was experiencing or seeing in my community. I didn't have a way to intellectualize them or to analyze them. I mean, I'm talking about like seeing women being beat by their husbands, going to funerals for young people who were killed in gang violence from the time I was really little, seeing people die young because they don't have access to adequate health care. All of this was sort of weighing down upon me. But I do think in a lot of ways, writing through these situations, thinking about violence against women, thinking about people that are so depressed that they're falling into alcoholism and they don't feel seen and they're experiencing displacement because of gentrification. I think exploring those psyches, it really allowed me to analyze my own psychology and to think about the choices that I was making. And I do think in many, many ways that if I had not written Sabrina and Karina, I'm not sure if I would even be alive today, because I was so lost in terms of binge drinking, in terms of my depression. This book really did save me. As a writer, I'm writing naturalistic, realist prose and stories that are really focused on the reality of my existence. And the entire center of my world is, it's always been, this very mixed Chicano community from Denver. And so when I looked out from, you know, my little center of the universe, that's what I saw first. And everything else about the American West, that came second or third or fourth. You know, I remember being at my Auntie Lucy's house and she would put on, you know, Turner Classic Movies, and sure enough, like a John Wayne movie would come on or something.
Get down off them horses. I don't favor looking up to the likes of you.
And, you know, we would watch The Searchers together, and it always seemed like such fantasy. Like, that was not the existence that we knew. Those were not the stories that we told. And so to me, that version of the American West, that was such a fantasy that when I started writing, when I started telling these stories, it wasn't my intention necessarily to redefine the American West, but to just offer a perspective that to me felt like the truth. I think early on when I first started writing, there was some worry that I was sort of going to air the dirty laundry, so to speak, because I am addressing very difficult topics. And one of the things that my family and a lot of other families did is they tried not to talk about the ugly things that they had experienced. They tried to move on really quickly. But growing up, you know, that was sort of a silent thing. We really needed to focus on looking forward and not looking back. That was what they would tell us. My godmother is 84 years old. You know, I was really nervous what she was going to think of Woman of Light, because essentially this is the story of her parents in a lot of ways, or it's inspired by her parents. It's inspired by her aunties and her uncles. And, you know, when she called me and told me she read it, I was like, what is she going to say? What does she think? And she goes, you know, my baby, I read it twice. I read my book twice. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, I can't believe that you took the stories and you knew what to do with them. And she said at one point while she was reading, she looked up at heaven and she said, look, you're in a book. And she tried to tell all of the ancestors that they're here, that they're in this book. And she said, I did a really good job. And I think her opinion on this, it means so much to me. And I feel so lucky that she's lived long enough that she got to read it and I got to hear what she thought of it. And so I'm proud that my family is happy to be seen and to be represented. And also that there are many, many other families who see themselves in these books.
This episode was produced by Reynaldo Leaños Jr. and edited by Daisy Contreras. It was mixed by JJ Carubin. The Latino USA team includes Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Marta Martinez, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Alejandra Salazar, Patricia Zulbarán, and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Julio Ricardo Varela. Our director of engineering is Stephanie LeBeau. Our senior engineer is Julia Caruso. Our associate engineer is Gabriela Baez. Our marketing manager is Luis Luna. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. In the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. And remember, no te vayas. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.